to this, the second part of our short three-part series on decolonising the curriculum across Eastern Arc and beyond. In the last episode, we heard about how far we had come in both recognising and tackling issues of embedded racism within higher education. Today, I want to look at the specifics of quite how white the curriculum is, but also how receptive each of the universities is to change. Joining me once again to talk about these issues are Barbara Adewumi, a postdoctoral research associate in student success at Kent, Patrice Mighton, who's working with her on the Diversity Mark project at the university, Hannah Gibson, who's a senior lecturer in linguistics at Essex, and Claire Hines, who's a lecturer in literature and creative writing at UEA, and is joined by a member of the BIPOC Student Ambassador Scheme there, Amy Ibarra-Hempel. The Diversity Mark project at Kent has been looking at a number of the curricula there. I started by asking Barbara and Patrice what they found.
Within social sciences, we found that over 80% of the modules that we had reviewed were white, male, and Eurocentric. And then in terms of gender, for white women, it was improving in the areas of 20 to 25% of the actual reading lists consisted of female authors. But then if you look at that more granularly, you were only getting up to about 8% of Black female authorship included within that. And I remember one of the interns in her presentations to staff, interestingly, said that a lot of the Black female authors that she reviewed tended to be co-authors rather than independent authors. So that could tell you a bit about belonging in itself within the whole publication of articles or books. So that's
quite interesting, isn't it? That co-authors point, which I guess indicates the long-term ingrained nature of that inherent racism of Black authors perhaps being excluded or not feeling included within their disciplines. In decolonizing the curriculum, the push to include more BME authors is an important and necessary part of it. Is there enough of a back catalogue, if you will, of those books, those texts, those journal articles, in order to properly shift the balance to be more equitable? Barbara, yes, please.
Oh, okay, that's a really good question. I mean, that's one of the jobs of the library, you know, that the work that they're doing is that they have joined up with other libraries to find out about niche publishers. And in fact, there is a process now where you can actually take your reading list, send it to a particular publisher, and they can tell you where you are lacking in diversity in that reading list. And they will find particular authors from the Global South to be included in the reading list. So what I'm saying there is that there are a wealth of male and female Black authorship or Global South authorship in articles and resources, as well as, of course, your traditional textbooks. But it's just, you know, being able to get them accepted by our publishers. You know, we also need to extend the debate about who is on the panels of these publishing selective committees, you know, who are allowing to what's supposed to be on the shelves or what can be chosen as academic books and core textbooks. But there's definitely a wealth of authorship there. It's just being able to pull them away from the margins and get them more to the centre of our curriculum.
And that's interesting what you say about the being able to correspond with the publishers about it. That sounds very positive. Is that commonplace, or are there only kind of one or two publishers offering that kind of service?
I don't know if it's commonplace, to be honest with you, because the library has only recently gotten involved in that process. So I think it's something that is evolving quite recently, because I think of, you know, decolonizing the curriculum and also Roads Must Fall and the whole movement that has shifted our thinking in how we can make a real change to learning and pedagogical practices.
Thank you. Hannah, both Barbara and Patrice talked quite positively about the role of the library in changing cultures and being open to the changing of culture. Is it the same at Essex? What's been your experience at a library?
Yeah, absolutely. I've had fantastic support and collaboration and sort of challenges from colleagues in the library. And we also use Talis, and that's been a really good resource. One of the benefits of teaching being shifted online this year has meant that we've had to make sure that all of our reading lists, all of our resource lists, are all of the materials available digitally online. And I've actually, you know, we've sort of been looking at the fact that this is actually quite a good opportunity to broaden out what we think goes on these lists. So again, encouraging people perhaps to think beyond reading blog posts, you know, like self-published work, videos, you know, all of these kind of things, which in a way are much more accessible, or they could be much more accessible, and links obviously to what Barbara was talking about, the power that publishing has. So if you have to go through one very particular process to publish a book, that narrows down who can do it and what's published and what makes money and all of those kind of things. If you can start including blog posts on your you know, reading lists and podcasts and things like that, then it can really open things up. So I think, yeah, library have been fantastic. And yeah, they've, with the link to the resources, and they understand how those work and how the reading list and things work, that's been great. And the other thing we've been able to do, again, using Talis, is have lists that are not associated to any module. So we have a decolonizing the curriculum resource list. We have an anti-racist reading group that's also been meeting. And again, we have resources on that, which is really easy to then share materials across the university. So students, academic staff, professional services, like everyone, you know, when you say, oh, can you recommend something on this? You can just put them in that direction. So I think that's been a really nice thing as well from that's, again, library support and infrastructure has made that possible.
Claire, do you recognise, Barbara talked about those percentages of the curriculum that came from BME or different non-male genders. Are those percentages kind of what you recognise from your experience at UEA?
Yeah, I do recognise those sorts of figures. I mean, we haven't done an audit in the same way, but in terms of, you know, an impression of those modules, I remember my first sort of teaching experiences of being teaching modules and just being confronted with practically everyone being white. And I remember, I feel like I shouldn't say this because I actually love UEA now, and I always have. But yeah, I remember one of my first teaching experiences doing my own sort of personal audit and counting up the number of references, because it was a really sort of prescriptive curriculum. And out of 100 references to writers, only one was non-white. And it wasn't even a text, you know, we hadn't even read a text. And so I recognise what Patrice was saying about that feeling of not seeing oneself within your studies and the profound impact that has on the individual. When we're thinking about questions about opportunities gap and who is advantaged in those spaces and who is disadvantaged, these questions are really important. And Phil, you mentioned, you know, you asked the question about, are there the writers there? And I would just say, yes, just so many writers or, you know, authors who aren't being given the time of day, basically. One of the writers who I'm particularly researching and looking at in my book is Zora Neale Hurston, who's an African-American writer. And she's someone who was a prolific writer in the last century, and her books went out of print. She's a staggering genius. I'm speechless. But, you know, the injustice of it, that, you know, you think Zora Neale Hurston was practically erased from our knowledge from universities, and how many more writers are there out there who we're forgetting? How many more are being overlooked? I think you know, it's quite sad in a way that we're not tapping into the range of writers who are out there, the range of different ideas, the range of different perspectives.
It's interesting what you say about Zora Neale Hurston, because she clearly had the platform initially that she was being published. It wasn't like she was being marginalised or put to the side. And yet she went out of print. Another Afro-American author, James Baldwin, for instance, who remains in print. What is the difference? Why did Zora Neale Hurston go out of print, whereas others like James Baldwin remained central and were accepted despite colour?
That's a difficult question. I don't know. I mean, it could be. I mean, there are broader questions in publishing about what kinds of stories from Black writers are acceptable, or what kinds of stories, you know, fit into particular expectations about what kind of stories should be told. And perhaps Zora Neale Hurston is an example of a writer who wasn't quite presenting the kind of stories that people wanted to hear, or that they were comfortable with. She didn't write for a white readership. She wasn't writing about racism in quite the same way. Perhaps it's a bit more complicated or difficult for people to kind of get to grips with. So I think there are questions there in terms of how acceptable particular writers are if they don't fit into preconceived ideas about, you know, what you should be writing about. And I think there's a sense that for white writers, they can perhaps write about anything, and the idea is that those ideas are universal. And if you're a Black or brown writer, then you need to think about the audience in a different way and what their expectations are. And if you're writing something that perhaps is very exotic, then that's great. Or if it speaks to a particular kind of racism that people are aware of, then that's fine. And if you're doing something a bit more, not say complicated, but if you're writing in a different way, then perhaps that's difficult for people to get to grips with.
I think that's true. I think that issue of how comfortable people are with a particular presentation or a particular work, or how acceptable they see it, is an interesting one. I want to come to Amy and Patrice about this and their work in being what Amy described as the bridge, or the mediator between the issues facing Black students and the governance or institutions of the institution. We've talked about the library being open and accessible and engaged with the issues. How have you found the institution itself in terms of response to the requests or the suggestions you make? Amy, could I go to you first?
Yeah, I think for the most part within my school, within literature, drama and creative writing, there's been an awareness that things really, really need to change and that the school is far behind. And as a result of that, it's been really great because there's been a lot of enthusiasm from members of staff, from the people who run the structure of the school, to make changes where possible and as soon as possible. So, you know, I feel quite grateful that my role is taken quite seriously and that members of staff come to meetings and they come to workshops with really listening and wanting to learn and wanting to hear from students of colour what actually it's like to study English in such a white school and how we can do better.
Patrice, what's been your experience?
I feel like there's definitely a percentage of people within the department that are open to having conversations and that want to like help or contribute to recognizing that things need to change. Something I've noticed a lot from being a part of this is it's a lot of the time it is spearheaded by women. A lot of the time I see that it's women who are more willing to have these conversations. Like, I would say I've seen a lot more women within the department engaging in these conversations, and prior to COVID attending certain like events. I feel like there are definitely people who recognize that things need to change, and I would say that women within the department are more engaged and active in making these changes happen.
So what do you think it is? And you might not have an answer at all, but why do you think it is women taking this forward in particular, or being more receptive to it?
Women, is a different experience, but women have experienced what it's like to be marginalized. Women have a similar understanding of marginalization. So I feel like when a woman does see something such as this occurring, and they think to myself, well, I can relate on what it feels like to be marginalized, maybe not exactly in the same way, but I can relate. So therefore, I feel like that's why there's more of a attempt from women and more of an understanding from women.
Student engagement has been really, really important to how seriously our school has taken decolonizing. A year ago, some students got together and wrote an open letter to the school about decolonizing, basically saying, enough is enough, this isn't good enough, we need more Black and brown text from ethnic minorities on our curriculum. And it was a brilliant letter, so well researched and well argued. They even provided an extensive list of BIPOC writers and texts that they thought would be beneficial to learn on the curriculum. And over 100 students signed it. I signed it myself. And kind of Claire will agree with me that it was very monumental in the school kind of realizing, okay, this is really, really what students want right now. It's also been really great to see how enthusiastic students in my school are. And there's a lot of teams kind of outside of my paid role that work to make LDC a better, more inclusive space. We have a decolonized UEA society that kind of sometimes works with LDC specifically. We have a colonized LDC undergraduate working group, which is entirely voluntary, but works really closely together with the school and members of staff the way I do, to try and make changes. And there's so many people who volunteer their time and their energy to make our school a better place. Yeah, student engagement is also a very, very big part at LDC.
So clearly there's a lot of work to be done, and there's the energy to meet the challenge. Next time we'll look at the steps we all need to take in order to overcome that ingrained racism. In the meantime, thanks to all the speakers today, Barbara, Patrice, Hannah, Claire, and Amy. And I hope you can join us next time for the third and final part of this series on decolonising the curriculum.